The tenure guidelines that I've received have been a little more amorphous than I would ideally like. Tenure at Loyola is, I mean, it's by no means automatic. I think this is something that the department is aware of, and I know that they're working on making these sorts of things more precise. The sort of rough guidelines that I've been given are about one, at least one good article a year, or a book and a couple of good papers. But that sort of still leaves open quite a lot, like what, how different types of publications are counted. I do know that, anything peer-reviewed ends up counting for a lot more than anything not peer-reviewed or peer-reviewed in, I mean, I should really say peer-reviewed in a very transparent and well-known way, such as, a reputable journal. Anything else, I get the sense, can raise questions about how rigorous the peer review process really was, and so is a liability. That's not stopping me right now from trying to publish a couple of things in book chapters as book chapters, but I know that I'm going to need to have quite a few just, straightforward papers in good journals as well.
Thank you. And I think Marjorie's question about seeing the CV of someone who was just tenured, I think, I just want to underscore, I think that's a great question to have written down. Great. And then switching over to teaching, how did you convert quarter-based syllabi that you taught to semester syllabi? And also, how did you figure out appropriate assignment expectations for a new student population?
I would say I thought before this semester that transforming a quarter-based syllabus into a semester-based syllabus would just mean filling it out a little bit. That was an incorrect assumption. The class that I've been doing that in did not go as well as I wanted it to, so I would caution you against thinking that it's as easy as that. And part of that is because expectations can be really different at different institutions in terms of the reading load students can take, the kind of things students are used to reading, the pace at which they're used to reading, and even just like really simple pedagogical things that take more time to get to students at certain institutions than at others, right? Making sure that they know how to use the library and cite things properly, making sure that they know how to take notes, making sure that they've properly read your syllabus. Not all of this is as obvious at other institutions as it is at Chicago. And so you have to build in time to do that kind of explicit work, which is something I hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, certainly. I pretty much created everything from scratch because I hadn't taught courses that were really that close to any of the things that I was being asked to teach. So far, I've taught three sections of an introductory course, but a very sort of quirky introductory course that they have at Loyola called Philosophy and Persons, which is meant to introduce philosophy somehow through the concept of personhood, and you get to kind of decide what that means. And then also a graduate course I taught in the fall. And so both of those were new. It was a lot of feeling out to kind of get the level that students are at. And I think my experience so far has been what I hear is quite typical. You sort of start off pitching things too high, and then you sort of pitch things too low, and then you kind of work out what a good level to pitch things at is. And I think I'm kind of finally getting there with my introductory class. I think like some of it, it went reasonably well the first time I taught it last semester, but some of it definitely was too advanced. And then I think I did in some places overcorrect in the other direction. So I think it's just a matter of titration, really.
I think I said this at the very beginning, but I really want to highlight it. Ask, like, I think it's completely acceptable to ask to see sample syllabi of the class you're being asked to teach, and to ask what is the vision for this class? How does it fit into the whole curriculum? And so where I am, we really focus on our 200 level classes as being writing heavy. And that's something I never would have known if I hadn't asked. And there's a lot of expectations around how much writing and the type of writing they're doing in these classes. And so I needed to see a syllabi to know that that was true. In terms of transitioning syllabi from Chicago to kind of this more of a semester-based, I took my learning objectives. And so those I think are something that are pretty much the same, right? And I would say I even kept my big assignments because I liked them. I thought they had done well. But then I basically rebuilt the rest of the class. So I thought about what did I want to do each week if I'm now dividing it by 15. Are they going to class 16 instead of 10? What are some topics that maybe I would have cut out before? What are some topics where I want to spend more time on it? And so I tried to not be wedded to the syllabus I had produced before, even though it was tempting to say, isn't it nice I have it done? I'll just like double the 2 weeks on some topics.
Just to continue the point about, asking for examples, which again, I completely agree with. And I think getting examples from more than one person in your department, just to kind of see, the range, especially if you like, you kind of like know based maybe from your campus visit, like who's the instructor who's likely to like maybe assign a lot of reading and who's the guy who's maybe a little bit, usually a guy, who's a little bit more laid back and kind of winging it a bit more week to week, just to kind of see like what is the spectrum and then deciding where you want to be on that spectrum. I also think, you in your first year are likely to be observed teaching by other people in your department. And I actually asked to be able to observe some of them as well in the classroom, just to kind of see like what are the kinds of norms and expectations here around discussion culture, for instance. Am I doing too much lecture? Am I doing too much discussion? Based on your department and discipline, these things will vary, but just kind of having a sense of how other people are in the classroom was also useful for me. I will say that when I was adapting my classes from, 10 weeks to 16 weeks, the first time I did this last semester, I actually didn't change a whole lot, in part because I felt like the amount of teaching that I was asking of my students at Chicago in 1 week is probably a little bit more than I wanted to ask from my students at the college that I'm at now. And so the kind of reading, if you just give an extra day or so here for this novel or this thing, it kind of ended up being a similar amount of time. And after teaching that last semester, I definitely would not have wanted to add more to, suddenly be able to have like a new unit. Again, this might just be a little bit discipline specific, but I think I actually found teaching in the semester for the first time that, by the same kind of week that you would be at in a quarter, like week 11 or something, the students are like kind of exhausted. And don't really have the capacity to keep going forward at the same pace that you wanted at the beginning of the semester. So for this past semester, I've built in a lot more they're not like fillers, but like workshop days where we don't have new reading, but maybe we're looking at each other's essays. Days where we just have more activities that didn't require students to prep ahead of time. And I think I do not feel any anxiety about continuing to have those in future iterations of classes where the load does kind of taper off a bit after week 10. And that might also mean that adapting from a quarter to a semester isn't always a very dramatic change. If you find that you can't, suddenly do 50% more material, but it's just about pacing it differently.
Yeah, just to chime in about pace, everything that's going on with coronavirus, I was very thankful that I had split up the quarter so that I had a lot of assignments all throughout and I didn't wait for the end because I had to make the final paper optional because I had a lot of students who were struggling to get home. So I would say another thing, both for the semester, but also for the quarter, I very much encourage spacing spacing it out. And I'll definitely be doing that more intentionally in the future. Great. So I don't see any new questions, but keep the audience should keep submitting them. One that I wanted to get to is, what are the mechanisms for mentoring where you are, and have you taken advantage of them? What has that been like for you? Or are there no mentoring that as well?
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I guess I'll start. I don't think we really have formal mechanisms at Loyola, but it's definitely a place where there are sort of people everywhere who want to be mentors, which is something really nice about the department. I feel like I'm getting that at different levels. Like there's a certain kind of mentorship that you can get from people who are still pre-tenure but getting closer to going up for tenure, or people who are recently tenured, and then another kind of mentorship that you can get from senior faculty. So whether or not there are sort of formal mechanisms in place, you'll very often find that, I mean, if you're in a healthy department, there will be people around who will be happy to mentor you in various ways.
Every junior faculty member at Beloit is assigned a mentor who is a tenured faculty member who's outside of your department, so that you kind of have a person that, you know, if problems do emerge in your department, or if you feel like there are concerns there, that you also have somebody that you can kind of get advice from. And I think that that's a model that I've really appreciated so far, to have somebody whose like job is just to kind of be in my corner. So this goes back to what I said at the very beginning too, of like kind of finding out who your people are at the institution, not necessarily like the people you plan to collaborate with on your research or that sort of thing, but just like, you know, who do you imagine kind of gelling with and being allies with. I think that having that kind of person who can also be a mentor is really useful. But in terms of, you know, within our department, there isn't like a sort of formal mentorship thing. But I think it's also just because, you know, we're kind of a smaller department. So a lot of that happens even without it being completely, you know, formal. You know, every person in my department, observes my teaching over the course of my first year, because there's only five other people. So there's kind of a bit more mentorship built in informal ways that way.
My department supposedly has a mentorship program, and the way that ended up working is when I showed up, my chair had a meeting with me in which he said, well, you can choose who your mentor is, which was actually very daunting, because it turned out very quickly I'm in a department where there's a lot of really intense politics that go back a long time. And so I was really afraid to pick somebody because of those politics. Because of that, I still don't have an official mentor, but sort of echoing what other people have said, I've sort of developed unofficial mentors, some of whom are also assistant professors, some of whom are now tenured both in my department and outside of my department. And some of those people have been really helpful in terms of just sort of emotional and social support. Some of them have been helpful in terms of navigating things in the department. And I think it's really important to sort of have a variety of people you can draw on.
I want to echo what everyone's saying. Absolutely, finding the people who are there to support you is essential. We do have a formal mentorship program. It sounds very similar to Michael's. I was assigned someone outside of my department, and he and I have met a couple of times. He's been really wonderful, and it has been someone who I felt like I can ask questions to that I couldn't ask anyone else to. We also have year-long first and second year faculty events, and they have been really helpful in meeting other people who are at the same stage, and also seeing who their mentors are, as other people that you know are interested in helping first year faculty. And I've connected with some of other people through that as well.
unmute myself. So a question actually following up on something I said about starting a job and trying to do syllabi, and how do you juggle this? And to go back to Marjorie, your point about splitting up your day, I was just wondering for all of you, what does your day look like? I think that was one of the hardest things for me to transition from being a graduate student, where I had a lot of control over my day and time. And some days I would have no one emailing me or looking for me, which is not the case. So maybe just any practical advice, and I can share a little bit of what I do as well. But yeah, maybe Marjorie, you can say a little bit more about how you track your time. What, you know, mechanisms do you use?
So I'm far from as successful as where we all think I am from this. But I realized after my first semester that I'd lost control. And so I basically started trying to be really careful about what I was doing so I could mark it. And so I used just a Google Calendar and I changed the color. So I try to represent the time I'm spending teaching, the time I'm spending doing research, and the time I'm doing service in clear colors that stand out. And so I can then look at the end of the week and say, like, what haven't I gotten to? What's been like bogging me down? What do I need to fit a little bit in? I have worked up the courage starting in like about January to close my door. And so that's one thing I recommend, is that at least when I say I'm doing research, when I say I'm editing papers, that is a time that it is okay to close my door. And it's okay that if you think a student is knocking, to just like let it go and just to reach out later to try to catch up. Yeah. That said, I do spend a lot of time in the office. I do think presence is important. But I have, when I really need to get something done, left to kind of work somewhere else.
I do the exact same thing Marjorie does in terms of using a Google Calendar with different colors for like service versus research versus teaching. So that's highly recommended. I started in my second semester not going into my office every day, because I realized that when I go into my office every day, I get pulled into all sorts of little things. And actually, I worked a lot better either at home or at a cafe. And I know that's not the departmental norm in all places. I sort of felt safe doing it after my first semester, because a lot of people told me it was okay if I didn't come in every day. And so I felt okay doing that. And that worked for me. Another just technique I've often used to sort of keep track of my time is I decide how much time something should take, like grading or putting together a lesson plan for the next day. And when that's done, it's done. End of story. And I don't let myself do more on it.
I would say another small thing that I have done, and I think, you know, I have anxiety issues around email, and it can take so much time, and that really, it still shocks me. But having a Google Doc where I have templates for certain emails, because I find I have to write the same thing so often, whether it's a template about someone asking for a recommendation, this is what I need. And actually, I got this idea from a senior professor. You know, things like, there are just so many form emails. So having form emails that you can cut and paste is a little small, a small thing that can help.
I mean, I don't know how much this is just a personal thing, but one thing that I realized after a while was how important it is for me what order I do things in a day. I can have the best intentions to get good research done, you know, in at 4 p.m. after teaching two classes, but it doesn't really happen. So I realized, actually, for me, I think more important than sort of exactly when I do what is what I do first.
Yeah, I hear that from a lot of, I remember one of my colleagues told me, whatever you do the first hour and a half, the first 3 hours, just the first thing you do is has to be something for your research. So to echo that, I think that's great. Anyone else before we have another question here? All right. So this is a great one. Have any of you had problems setting boundaries with students? My first years and past two quarters have been way more demanding than my students in the past, and I've struggled with preserving my own time and energy. I think that'll be some thoughts on that.
I mean, I'm not afraid of, having set office hours and those being the sort of designated time that I'm usually able to meet with students. I think it's okay to also just communicate early on, and you know, if you have students who actually do read your syllabus, even communicating in your syllabus, you know, I really value having, you know, one-on-one conversations. It's a great opportunity for us to be able to think out loud and work through problems together. But, you know, I find it's also best if, you know, this is something that we can plan a little bit ahead of time. So, you know, I like to have 48 hours to set up meetings, and, you know, prefer that if we can keep it within, you know, these spaces, just, you know, communicating that you're there for them, but that that might also require that you not be there for them all the time. But I think it also, depending on what the demands are of your particular students, it also, I think, is about knowing who else you can refer them to talk about specific things. So, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of my students come to me about is, as one of the few sort of queer faculty members in a small liberal arts college, you know, I'm one of the people that they can come talk to about issues that are related to their gender identity or their sexuality, or how that's being, you know, treated in their classes. And so it's important that I can be that person for them. At the same time, that it's also important that I know, like, who are the other sort of allies on campus when it comes to issues that maybe I don't have the professional expertise to navigate. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not trained as a social worker or a therapist. So knowing who I can get them in contact with sooner rather than later is also important. So just kind of knowing, I think, like, what your sort of second lines of defense are and things like that, so that some of that advising or counseling labor can be spread around, but also being, you know, intentional in your schedule and things like that about setting up some concrete boundaries.
I've also tried to automate some of this, not the advising part, but in terms of scheduling with me. And so I do use an online program so students can book appointments. And in that, I have them write down like a sentence or two about what they want to talk about, because I think it helps focus our conversation and know what we're going to do. At a school that really values relationships between faculty and students, I do feel like I hear a lot of like very personal information. And what's helped is to know that it's important for them to share, and like Michael was saying, where I can refer them, but also to know that sometimes I can just listen and I don't have to, they don't need anything, right? And like what I'm providing is listening. And so it is 20 minutes, they sign up for the appointment, that's fine. And just to like thank them for sharing and to move on.
Yeah.
Sorry, keep going.
No, go ahead, Marjorie.
Oh, I was just saying to like not internalize it. I felt like at UChicago, a lot of times I felt like things students told me, I held them very strongly. I had a hard time moving past them. And I think trying to view things as part of the experience of college has helped a little bit.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you can book me as the website I use. I don't know if you use that one, but I find that very helpful. I would also say to prepare yourself for, especially if you are closer in age, whether it's to the graduate students or undergraduates, you know, I never thought, I remember hearing people above me, especially my female colleagues, were really bothered when they weren't addressed as professor or doctor, and sort of saying, oh, you know, I didn't have a doctorate, so I didn't really think about it. And this past quarter, I've noticed I had a couple of students call me Ms. And I don't think they didn't mean anything by it, but it bothered me more than I thought it would. So I think, you know, also preparing yourselves for those, in those moments when, you know, I wanted my students to call me by my first name. And now I realize that there's wisdom in using professor and doctor. And luckily I had a writing tutor working with me, and I didn't want to address the student myself who kept calling me Ms., but I had the tutor, you know, model how you address a professor, because partly for the student herself, because I didn't want her to go on and be in a class where a professor might be more harsh about titles and things like that. Anyone else? This is a great question. No, okay. All right. So I guess to go a little bit back to the idea of service, how do you think, you know, they're looking forward if you've just started, how do you think navigating service expectations? Kristen, you noted that your department has certain politics. Like how do you think you can either negotiate around service or frame service, contain it? Does anyone have any advice or ideas about that?
So in my case, service ended up being a bit of a burden this year because both of my departments were sort of going through very particular moments. So the anthropology, sociology department was having a lot of meetings to sort of deal with a lot of things that had happened last year, actually. And the international studies department was having a lot of meetings because they were going through like a 10-year review, which ended up taking a lot of time. And so I saw my schedule for the spring, for example, and there were like over 16 meetings. I was having a meeting like every Monday and Wednesday or something like that. And I didn't know what to do about that. And I was worried it was really going to eat into my research time, which already was not as much as I would have liked it to be. And so I ended up speaking to one of my senior colleagues. And so she was able to sort of advocate for me. And if I needed to not go to a meeting, to sort of vouch for me. And so I found that to be more comforting and more helpful than maybe going directly to the chair.
To add on to this question, there's been an excellent sort of follow-up. Any problems with faculty from underrepresented groups being burdened with all of the diversity requests?
I mean, yes, in terms of there being a kind of expectation that my courses will be the courses that teach more diverse material is one of the ways that that comes out. Yes, it also is just about, you know, particularly my queer students and students of color are more likely to just take my classes and to want to like be able to have a person that they can talk with. I think that there's a way in which that's, you know, a kind of tax, but there's also a way in which you can kind of spin that to your advantage. In as much as like, I actually really enjoy interacting with my queer students or students who, you know, maybe are having more of a sort of political relationship to some of the material that they're learning. So making that into some part of your service, but having it recognized, I think is what is important. So when your department can recognize that, you know, working with student groups, for instance, is a form of service, even if it isn't like serving on a committee, you know, providing these kinds of resources for your students, if those are the kinds of things that you enjoy doing, then I think it's just about making sure that it's recognized as the kind of service it is, as opposed to it just being, you know, the added sort of affective labor that you're expected to do. I think part of that also means understanding like what are the official sort of service mechanisms around diversity and inclusion. You know, what are the committees or ongoing working groups? And would participating in those forums be a tax to you, or would those forums be an opportunity for all the labor you're doing anyways to be recognized? I think it's going to depend on the specific, you know, committee or working group. But I think that there's been some opportunities I've been able to find at my college where, you know, I can just kind of show up for a meeting, and then that kind of also authorizes a lot of or legitimizes a lot of the things that I'm just doing with my students on a sort of day-to-day basis. Like it becomes the line you can put on your CV, in other words, for all the things that you're doing that you can't put on your CV. So finding ways to, you know, maybe spin those things into a space where they're recognized or legitimized has been important for me.
Another really important way to get that sort of labor recognized officially by your department is to make sure to actively track it and then to put it into whatever end of the year faculty activity report you have to write up. I don't know if you all have the same thing we have to do one here. It's much more detailed and in-depth than the one that I had to do as a graduate student at Chicago. And the older faculty of color who have ended up having to do a lot of sort of unrecognized emotional labor have encouraged me from the beginning, if I'm meeting with a lot of students, track how many and which students I'm meeting with and enumerate that on the faculty activity report so that all of that becomes visible as service.
I also tried to say yes to things that were easy, things that I felt like weren't a major commitment, which made me feel like a team player. And I think made my department view me like a team player, even though they weren't things like serving on a committee in my first year. So things like helping set up a dinner for students at a conference, right? So things that are one-off that I can schedule as I could fit it in, I think made my department feel like I was participating and made it easier to say no to other things like I just can't fit that in now.
Yeah, I'd also say, one of my research areas is gender and sexuality, and I found myself, I think I was on my fourth or fifth event or service that I was being, item that I was being asked to speak at or participate in. And I did mention very gently, I can also talk about other things. So I wouldn't be afraid to sometimes point that out if you don't want to always be the person who has to address those issues. But I do think being a team player, and often it's energizing. I find, especially interacting with the students, as Michael said, I think is great. Good, so yeah, and a new question. What on the ground does a department chair actually do? What does it look like to develop a good relationship with the person as a new faculty member?
I could start. I think that's a really good question. Yeah, I didn't have as clear an idea before I started. Basically, it seems to me like at least one of the main roles of the departmental chair is as a go-between the department and the administration, right? So, you know, the department will have some sort of deliberation in a meeting that bears on, you know, some sort of curriculum decision or hiring decision. And, you know, if it's something very important, then usually it's the chair's responsibility to sort of distill that and accurately convey the department sentiment to the provost or whoever or the dean in the administration and negotiate and try and get what the department wants. That's certainly not all they do, but that's, I didn't realize how central that was to the chair's role before I started.
In terms of developing a good relationship with your chair, I'm lucky enough to have a chair who's very wonderful and friendly and helpful. And so what that's meant for me is we've gone out for coffee like twice a semester just so that I can ask any questions that I have and we can just sort of talk about how things are going more generally. And that's been a really nice way to sort of get to know him and get to know the department.
Great. So just to keep us conscious of time, are there any you've noticed about the transition from being a graduate student and writing a dissertation to being a tenure track faculty member that you would like to share, you think is important to keep in mind?
I mean, I can say one thing maybe about that transition. I mean, for me, one of the biggest parts of the transition from at least specifically the University of Chicago, to being at a liberal arts college in a sort of smaller city in Wisconsin, is that I kind of took for granted a lot of the sort of resources that are available at Chicago, including just like, you know, events that people have, you know, like you have really cool people coming and giving talks that you can learn from. And as a graduate student, there's kind of more of a built-in sense of community, maybe because of the workshops you go to, or just because you have a cohort that you like, or, you know, friends. but that kind of community is not as immediately provided or institutionalized at my college, because, you know, we don't have a graduate student workshop system, or we don't have, you know, some of these other types of things. So it's been really important to me to kind of develop more virtual community in this transition. So people that I'm working with or sharing work with, you know, from afar, to kind of maintain some of that, you know, spirit of a workshop, for instance. So I think one of the things that I would have told myself, or I would tell myself a year ago now, is to kind of make a list of some of like the things I do on a day-to-day basis or like a weekly basis at Chicago, like going to a workshop, going to a talk, thinking about which of those things are going to be present or as present in my next institution, and then think about, you know, what are some substitutes for some of these structures or systems or events if they aren't going to be as available, just so that there's a bit more of a continuity in the kind of intellectual or collaborative experience that you want to be have. Again, I think that'll be different if you're at a larger institution, and if, you know, you do have graduate students, for instance, but I think still just kind of trying to anticipate what are some of the things that you might miss on a more daily or weekly basis, and how could you try to approximate that.
I guess just with respect to writing too, one of the things that I'm still navigating and trying to get used to is needing to think a lot more about, you know, how some piece of writing that I'm doing is going to be used. I think when I was a grad student, I spent a lot more time writing about things just because, you know, they fit into some big project in a kind of systematic way, or, you know, frankly, just because it was some philosophical issue that I was interested in and I felt like writing about, and, you know, I want to still be able to do that and make that the motivation behind a lot of my writing. But I now need to think about, okay, you know, what sort of journal am I going to publish this in? Or, you know, is this going to be in a journal, or what's this piece of writing for, right? If I'm giving a talk somewhere, I feel a lot more pressure to actually think about the talk in a way that will eventually lead to some kind of publication, whereas I didn't so much before. I did sort of on a big picture scale, like I need to have some kind of marketable project, but not so much about each individual thing that I write.
I really want to echo what both of you just said. I definitely feel a loss of community. It's definitely harder to track down journal articles, so I really appreciate all of my friends at UChicago who still download articles for me all the time. And also finding community has definitely been a hard part. One thing that I was hesitant to do that did really help once I became less embarrassed was to reach out to the other schools in the community and say, can I come to your graduate student workshop, right? And just being on that email list, I only went 3 times so far this year, but that gave me part of the things I was missing, and from that was able to make these other connections. One really nice thing about the transition has been the opportunity to think a lot about what am I really interested in, right? So what do I want to spend my time researching and writing? I have such limited time. So what is something that I'm going to be passionate to do? And so I want to suggest that despite the transition being hard, there have been really wonderful parts.
Yeah, building on what Marjorie said, I would just encourage people when they leave Chicago and go to another place to sort of take advantage of what that place has to offer. So I was a bit sad when I left Chicago because there was a really vibrant linguistic anthropology community there. And I'm now at an institution where I'm the only person who does something even remotely close to linguistic anthropology. And I could spend my time being sad that I've lost that. But I think what's been much more helpful is looking for sort of the dynamic hubs of research that are happening at the institution that I'm at. And it turns out there's a lot of really amazing work being done in like critical race studies and sound that's great and of interest to me. And so I wouldn't say that I'm explicitly trying to change my interest to be in line with those, but sort of developing my interest in a different kind of community than I had at UChicago, and just sort of being open to the fact that those are things you might want to be a part of, even if they're different.
I think these are all great points. I would also say stay in touch with your advisors and your mentors, because I remember the first few weeks getting emails that just helped make that transition, and they're all cheering you on, so don't forget that. All right, well, Marjorie, Kristen, Michael, Joshua, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great panel, so thank you so much. And thank you everyone for attending and your great questions. Bye.